Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to Free Exchange, the CapEx podcast. We're here with Nick Cohen, a writer for The Observer and Spectator and author of, among other books, What's Left, a study of how liberals lost their way, which, to quote its author, grows depressingly more topical with every wretched day. So, Nick, I want to start. In your book, you say this. There exists a subterranean world. This is quoting Norman Cohn. There exists a subterranean world where pathological fantasies disguised as ideas are churned out by crooks and half-educated fanatics for the benefit of the ignorant and superstitious. There are times when this underworld emerges from the depths and suddenly fascinates, captures and dominates multitudes of usually sane and responsible people. Would you say that's a pretty good summary of what's happened in politics in the last 10 years?
Yes, I believe that very strongly. I think something very odd happened after the Cold War, with whatever you want to call it, the end of history, the triumph of capitalism, is that vast numbers of people, you can call it the neoliberals or the Washington consensus, whatever you want. The consensus was, this is the only way to run the world, and we needn't take notice of the extremes. And people didn't take notice of irrational passions and irrational ideas, which, considering what happened in the 20th century, was an extraordinary oversight. So I was writing that book, it was nearly 10 years ago now, and I was noticing about my side of politics on the left how very, very weird, often really quite reactionary ideas were developing in opposition to the consensus. But you could say the same with, you look at Trump and you look at Le Pen. You know, you go back to when Trump was in the Republican nominations. He's a good laugh. He's a reality TV star. He won't get anywhere. How can he get anywhere? It's just impossible. Poor old Norman Cohen, in my view, has been proved right. You know, there is a subterranean world and it does rise up. And, incidentally, those supposedly sensible centrists turn out to be not so centrist and not so sensible after all, and they will go along with it, as long as it's sort of their side.
And so that's what your diagnosis of Brexit would be?
Brexit, I think, is slightly different from Trump. Brexit is far more complicated, although the way it was sold to the British public, as if we can have it without tears, Brexit without tears, we can have it all, you know, was just open mendacity. And I wonder what is going to happen when it turns out there is a price to pay for this. I do wonder how 70 million people who voted to leave are going to react.
If it all goes wrong?
It's going to be hard. And, you know, Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, Nigel Farage were very like Alex Salmond in the Scottish independent referendum. They had their other. For Salmond it was the English, for Vote Leave it was the EU. But they never said, this is going to be difficult. If you want Scottish independence, if you want out of Europe, it's going to be hard. They're kind of anti-Churchillians, all these modern politicians. There's never any blood, sweat, toil and tears. You know, everything is going to be easy. Everything is going to be fine. And you say if it all goes wrong. If it all goes wrong, it's perhaps too simple. It's going to be very difficult. There will be prices to pay. And the public was not told that.
Yes, I mean, the idea that politics and economics and everything is always a game of trade-offs.
Yeah.
But everything is being presented as absolute goods and absolute, absolute evil.
Having said that, I don't regard the Brexit vote as the same thing as the Trump vote, and the same thing as Corbyn taking over the Labour Party. I think it's more complicated, and it's got a lot to do with Britain's history, England's history in particular, that going back to Norman Cohen, you know, every other country in Europe, with the exception of Switzerland and Sweden, was either invaded by the Nazis or invaded by the communists, often invaded by both, or had the Greek colonels, or Franco, or Salazar. So the EU was a way out of a terrible past. We didn't have that.
Yes, it was a transactional relationship.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's got far more to do with Britain's history than simply an irrational vote.
Mentioning Franco and Salazar, you start what's left with a lovely story of how you never had oranges growing up as a kid, because your mother refused to buy them from the Spanish dictators, the French dictators, the Portuguese dictators, sorry, you know, from Nixon's America, from Israel. So, you know, is it fair to say your politics was sort of inherited rather than acquired?
Yeah, I grew up in a very left-wing family. Not communist, but that strange, talking about people going along with things. As you see on the right wing today. I grew up in a family where, you know, it was sort of axiomatic that the West was at least morally equivalent to the Soviet Union, and that what you protested about was Vietnam or the Greek colonels, say. My parents weren't extreme left. I mean, my father made me read Salt, or encouraged me, not made me, encouraged me to read Solzhenitsyn when I was a boy, and Orwell, and, you know, I was brought up on that as well. But it is this world which you still see in Corbyn's Labour Party, the Greens, the Lib Dems, to a way where what you know about is protesting against Western democracy, and that's not wholly bad. There are lots of good reasons for doing it. There's lots to protest about. But that was the world I was
and to be left-wing is to be virtuous, and to be virtuous is to be left-wing.
I genuinely it took me a long time, probably till I was in my 30s, to be able to regard anyone who's conservative as anything other than immoral. I could not see how you could be a decent man or decent woman and be a conservative until I was really quite old. What changed? I think conservatism became better under Cameron and Osborne. That's all gone now. I think what changed was my view of the left, although the left is far too, there are dozens of lefts in Britain, you can't generalize, but the dominant form of the left, which I have come to regard as in its own way as reactionary as certainly UKIP, and in some of its alliances as reactionary as neo-fascists or Le Pen or the BNP. If you look at what they go along with, they don't actually follow principles, particularly with regard to women's rights or gay rights. Or they will ally with the most extreme.
The idea that stop the war means stop America's wars, but Russia's wars are fine, and Iran's wars are fine, and Iraq, yeah.
Well, it's worse than that. Stop the war means openly supporting what they called the resistance in Iraq, which were Al-Qaeda death squads. It means Seamus Milne, Corbyn's advisor, going to some Black Sea resort and sucking up to Putin in the most toadying fashion. It also means that you can have no comradeship, to use that rather interesting left-wing idea. You know, what is an Iranian feminist meant to do? If she is trying to organise support for the oppression of women in Iran, she turns to people who call themselves left-wing in Europe and North America, who call themselves feminists or socialists, or interestingly, for reasons we might get to, hardly anyone uses the word socialist anymore, or liberals or whatever, and they say no, you can't support, we won't support you, we won't protest on campuses about you, we won't lobby Amnesty International to do anything about you, because somehow by doing that we're supporting imperialism. And this leads to a very bizarre world where, you know, the rights for women are all very well for white-skinned women in Hampstead or Highgate, but not for brown-skinned women in Tehran or Baghdad. It is, as I say, that is, in my mind, certainly point of view of universal human rights, a highly reactionary position to be in, but is one where large numbers of certainly intellectual left have found themselves.
And for you, the kind of the breach point, I guess, was Saddam Hussein, where suddenly, when he invades Kuwait and becomes America's enemy, everyone starts going, "What a great person!"
I'm rather an exception here. I'm the only person for whom the Iraq war made me less left wing. Has to be said. No, it was simply because if you read that book, which begins with Iraq, is simply because, you know, I've been involved in campaigns for support for Kurds who have been subject to genocidal violence, gassing, you know, full Hitlerian violence by Saddam.
And one of your colleagues at The Observer had been killed.
Murdered by, yes. Fazer Bazov. And it wasn't that people were opposed to Tony Blair or George W. Bush. It was the way they went automatically in support of a regime, to use an overused word, you could genuinely describe as fascist. And it had the great leader. It had the omnipresent terror state.
The golden statues.
The golden statues. And it gassed, actually gassed, ethnic minorities. Impure ethnic minorities, non-Arab ethnic minorities, the Kurds. And I kept thinking, well, when is the left, and when is, you know, the liberal mainstream? You know, one of the interesting things about Corbyn is, and what's happening is, the far left is being portioned away from the liberal mainstream. But the liberal mainstream is highly complicit in all of this. You know, when am I going to hear a presenter on the BBC just ask the question, okay, fine. Dreadful business, George W. Bush. But, you know, what do you say to all the victims of this regime? Where are you politically? Now, if it had just been Iraq, I could understand that crises, you know, push people into oppositions. But it is sort of everywhere, though things are perhaps getting a bit better. You know, if I were to show you an article from any newspaper in any language and hand it to you, and its defence of, say, the Muslim Brotherhood, which believes in the subjugation of women, the execution of homosexuals, anti-Semitism, the execution of any Muslim who of his or her own free will decides to renounce their faith. And say, what type of newspaper is this in? And you say, well, obviously, this is a left-wing newspaper. And you have to stand back a bit and just say, how weird is that? And what on earth has happened to understand, you know, just how bad things have got?
But for you, this wasn't just a sort of academic exercise where you wrote a few articles and made your point.
No.
I mean, this had a real personal cost. I remember a few years back, I went to an event you were speaking at, and there were a couple of young Muslim guys in the audience, and every time you opened your mouth, they just started shouting at you. And you basically had this kind of personal hate squad which followed you around to public appearances.
No, I still do to an extent, but I mean, it doesn't follow me. I mean, one good thing about my childhood was, you learn to be unpopular. And you learn to think, well, that's all right. I mean, or to expect it. To get your pleasure out of the struggle, so to speak. That's absolutely, you know, that doesn't bother me at all. I mean, one of the interesting things about what the web has done has made an awful lot of people used to this. And, you know, because you get the stalkers on Twitter, you get the lunatics in comment sections under whatever you write. Everyone does. I mean, you would if you wrote anything, yeah, however anodyne. So you just get used to it and ignore it.
But, I mean, did you lose any friendships over this?
Not good friendships, no. I mean, one reason why I become more tolerant, you know, I now have conservative friends, for instance. You know, extraordinary thing to have. I can't quite say I've never kissed a Tory, but I don't always check in advance these days. To me, a civilised life means you do not lose good friends over politics. You know, you don't let politics become so important that you endanger friendship. I mean, weak friendships, drinking friendships, yes, I have done, but, you know, so on. If someone breaks a friendship with you over your politics, I just think they were never really a friend in the first place.
Which is an interesting contrast with your Islington neighbour Jeremy Corbyn, who broke up his marriage because his wife wanted to send their kid to a selective school.
Jeremy, yeah, I know. That is a type of fanaticism, or it's a type of purity. There's one thing that's always struck me, no one mentions it, but when I was young, a great political event was the miners' strike. Very, very powerful moment in late 20th century history when you sort of felt you're left, the miners had to win, even knowing all how badly they were being led by Arthur Scargill. But there was a moment at the end of the strike where Arthur Scargill had led the miners to disaster and the trade union movement to disaster, because the consequences of losing that strike were just massive. And at every stage during the strike, where Thatcher, or at least the National Coal Board, who weren't quite as bad as people like to paint them, were trying to get a compromise solution, and Scargill was saying no. He never wants to be accused of being a sellout. And so he leaves them clear. And by the end, miners are virtually starving. You know, they're begging for food. The union is broken. The union movement is broken. And Len Murray, I think, asked him, when it's finally all over, he said, how do you feel, Arthur? And Scargill comes out with one of those terrifying lines, I think, in left-wing history. He said, I feel pure. And Corbyn will be like that. Whatever happens now, he will feel pure. So, to my mind, I don't think he will give up the lead to the Labour Party. I don't think it will matter if Labour go down 55 seats, they did in 1931. I think he has got to keep going until he can hand it on to someone equally left-wing. Otherwise, he'll be impure. And he'll be accused of selling out.
Yeah, I mean, it must have been a sort of weird and slightly traumatising experience for you to see all these people you researched and you knew about suddenly, you know, these creatures from the fringes suddenly popping up in the, well, taking over the party.
Yes, it was. On the other hand,
very good for business.
Very good for business, yes, indeed. On the other hand, you know, I'm now being hailed as a prophet and people are buying my books. And as I say to everyone, you know, you don't have to read them, you just have to buy them. I may be greedy, but I'm not a sadist. And people buy books, somebody hails a prophet. I do like what Andrew, if I'm truly a prophet, I'll put a grand on Corbyn when he was 500-1 free Labour leader and done very well out of it. But also, every generation, I think, has got to learn its own from its own mistakes. And I do hope that the reaction against Corbyn will produce something better on the left.
Which I suppose is that Fukuyama point, that, you know, people thought it was over and they didn't have to make the argument, the sort of first principles arguments, yes, again, about why, you know, liberal economics but also liberal social values are a good thing.
Yes. And you can still see that in a lot of... you still see that, I would say, as much on the centre-right as on the centre-right.
So I was going to say, it feels like the natural sort of sequel to what's left now is who's right.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Perhaps I should have started a few years ago. It is very, very interesting watching Conservatives, how they react to Trump and react to UKIP and react to Johnson and Gove, is that who is going to stand up and say, well, actually, we're Conservatives, we don't believe in it, and who goes along with it? In other words, who is so caught up in partisan politics they would rather die than offer any comfort to, I don't know, The Guardian, you know, who cannot break with their own side, even when their own side is no longer their own side, even when Conservative principles on free trade, for instance, protectionism, the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, even they're all going out the window. My God, if I say anything, I'm giving comfort to all those ghastly social workers and muesli eaters and every cliche you've got. And Trump is quite clever at exploiting this. Everyone goes on about his attacks on the media. But literally, as far as I can see, I'm not a great expert on the American, but about the one thing that unites Conservatives in America, and I'd say Conservatives here, is their hatred of the liberal media. Yeah. And so by doing that, Trump is carrying along people who ought to be having severe doubts about it.
I mean, there's a phrase you use in your book, which I spotted you about the left, which I then spotted you using about the right the other week, which is a dark liberation. The idea that, you know, if you're someone in the centre, who's been sort of spending their life sitting there reading policy papers, and suddenly there's a kind of mass movement and a feeling of, you know the men with almost the men with the armbands.
Well, it's what I mean, but, you know, working class men with big muscles, you know, the kind of guys you never met at school, the kind of guys, you know, you thought would always be, you know, running strikes or you'd be having to call police arrest. Suddenly they're all on your side. They're all right wingers now. You know, and we can claim to be the true party of the working class. And it is an exhilarating feeling for them, and they will, and you can see it happen, trample over a lot. I said the other day that, you know, in America, there are really principled conservative writers and thinkers attacking Trump. And in Britain, one picks up the right-wing press and just sees attacks on Trump's opponents. Oh, weren't those women marching terrible? Weren't they ridiculous? Or look at the liberal press, blah, 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 blah. And I said, you know, why aren't there conservative English conservative intellectuals doing the same thing, and various English conservative journalists all started pointing me to this or that or the other and protesting I was being unfair, and perhaps I was to
I think certainly about Trump that's unfair.
I was being unfair, but I mean, you still, I look at the conservative press, I look at the Telegraph, the Mail, you know, and they don't quite know, they still seem very uncomfortable criticising the right wing, which is moving away, which is, you know, how is this conservative? And equally, and here is, there is a connection with Brexit, and it is fair to say, if you look at them now, the way the right wing is shouting down anyone
who's like the enemies of the people,
enemies of the people kind of stuff, which is a denial of the possibility of opposition.
And John Major and Tony Blair.
And Blair. It's always personal. And the way they are getting away from Italy, you know, it's a very difficult circumstance, the Burkean ideal of what a Member of Parliament should be. You know, we've just had something quite remarkable. The House of Commons have voted us to leave the EU, and the majority of the House of Commons thinks we should stay in the EU.
Yeah.
What is going to happen if, to use your words, it all go wrong? What are those MPs going to do from Theresa May, starting with Theresa May, who incidentally voted to remain Britain's stay in the EU? What are they going to say to the constituents who go, I never believed in this. I thought it was a stupid idea, but you know, we have to follow the referendum results. Will the public accept that? Or will they say, well, hold on a second, you're meant to be our leaders?
But I mean, I think this speaks to a bigger thing, which I kind of wrote about it in my own book, about how the sort of representative function is being stripped out.
Yes.
In Dave Eggers' book, The Circle, there's this idea that you're going to end up with a sort of thing on your watch which flashes up and goes, you know, should we bomb Syria, yes or no? And everyone pushes the button, and that's how it happens. What's important is the unfiltered will of the people at that particular instant must be obeyed.
Yeah. I think that's true, and that's what's happened in the Labour Party as well. I mean, it is extraordinary that whatever it was, 2/3, 3/4 of Labour MPs say, we do not want this man as our leader, and he's still the leader because the members have voted for him. And you can say, well, yes, that's the modern world, Nick, that is 300,000 people who are pressing their watch and saying, yes, we want Jeremy Corbyn. On the other hand, does it work? Will it work? We are still a parliamentary democracy. It is actually impossible to lead if you don't have support from majority members in the House of Commons. We are still a parliamentary democracy. So, on one hand, you're right, and that is absolutely true. One world is exactly how you describe it. On the other hand, it doesn't work. We will see if Brexit works. I have very strong doubts. It certainly hasn't worked in the case of the Labour Party, having a presidential election system in effect they've got with primaries, with a parliamentary party system. It just cannot be made to work.
So, I mean, I suppose, how do you fix this? I mean, what's it?
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found. That project manager I could never seem to hire? And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Is what we need, I suppose, is the locus of opposition to this stuff, the sort of, given the strength of the Tory party, kind of going to have to be the within the Tory party? Or do you see that kind of liberal realignment that people are talking about, of, you know, forming a new party or some sort of kind of coalescing of all the people who sit around in Islington at dinner parties?
Well, I think 48% of the population is rather more than people sitting around been part of this and this and so on. It's as I keep pointing out, and they keep saying we're elitist, so this must be the biggest elite in world history, you know, 60 million people. I think several things. I think that the Conservative Party, we'll see if it holds together, but there are massive tensions building up in it between, if you like, liberal conservatism, which is, you know, George Osborne, globalist, and English nationalist conservatism, which is, you know, Ian Duncan Smith, although that's one side. I think there are tensions between business, big business and small business, between, you know, sort of most big businesses, medium-sized businesses, unless Theresa May gets a good deal, for which she'll have to make big concessions. The Conservatives will no longer be the party of business. That would be a very, very big moment. So we will see what happens with the Tory party. I do think, call me a cockeyed optimist, I do think that the seeds of the next 1997 are being sown now. I do think that because the right has chosen to go for the hardest Brexit they possibly can, there will be a big liberal realignment and if you like, a liberal backlash politics coming. And I can feel it. I can't give you data, I can't prove it, but you can see it's happening. You can see it happening on the left in that Corbyn has lost virtually all intellectual support. I mean, I can't think of any writer or serious figure apart from actors who are supporting him anymore. It's just because suddenly the world's got serious and this is no longer a game where you can say, okay, we'll put our man in and maybe in 5, 10, 20, 30 years we win an election on our policies, because that assumes that Conservatives are gentlemen who, when you're like a player who's off the field injured, they will stop the game and hold the ball until you get back on the field. Of course they're just going ahead and driving ever further rightwards. And you do feel that intellectually that's all over and there'll be a big realignment. But the mechanics of how you get there, I mean, there's a huge market for it. The mechanics of how you get the product to market are, as you rather hinted, are rather formidable.
Oh, especially, I mean, you know, Tony Blair, it must be quite ironic, you know, you were one of the early critics of Tony Blair and New Labour, but now it's that's the gap in the market. But Blair himself is, you know, despised.
He called me in before he made that speech and we had a chat, and I don't think I'm breaking the confidence. When he said, well, you know, do you think I should do this? Because, you know, so many people hate me. And I said, well, you know, I mean, that wasn't a verbatim quote, but, you know, it's difficult for me to do this given my popularity. I'd be careful what I say. And I said, well, some people do. I mean, the Mail do, the Guardian do, but lots of people don't, first of all. And then lots of people will disagree with you on the right, they agree with you on this. So, you know, just get on with it, speak. You know, you shouldn't be worried about things like that. I think it's very telling that people like Blair and Major, having come out of retirement, and George Osborne made quite an interesting speech last night about it all, just pointing out very, very obvious things.
Yeah. This won't be broadcast for a few weeks, but...
George Osborne made a speech recently just pointing out very, very obvious things, that we would, you know, losing full membership of the single market, you'd have to get the most stunning trade deals for the rest of the world to even begin to compensate with that. And it's interesting that you're getting people who are out of power or retired just trying to shake the Conservative Party out of to go back to Norman Cohen's quote, you know, trying to get some of them to regain their senses. And those are the only voices powerful enough doing it, because one of the most notable things that happened is what's happened to the moderate Conservatives. You know, what's happened to all these people who supported David Cameron, who campaigned for Britain to stay in the EU? Only Ken Clark on the Tory side voted against Article 50. So, you know, all these Nicky Morgans and people who make a big fuss and a big noise, you know, where are they all now? What are they going to do?
Well, I suppose, I mean, I'm sort of in a similar position myself. I voted Remain, but my sort of theory is that once you've decided to do Brexit, you have to do Brexit. You know, the alternative is, you know, the same thing we have now, but a bit crapper on every level. Unless you actually go for something and say, okay, we're really going to, you know, we're going to try doing the trade deals with everyone else. We're going to, you know, reinvigorate ourselves. You know, this, you know, obviously you want to have the as close as possible deal with Europe, but, you know, there's no point to going through the pain unless you're going to build something actually different at the end of it.
Well, that's a very fair argument. It was not, however, an argument made during a referendum campaign. There was no mention of pain by Vote Leave. There was no acknowledgement that there would be pain. So what happens when that pain comes? Now, two things could happen. The first, I would say, because this is what I want to happen, and people would always love to dress up their preferences as impartial predictions, is that the country will turn on the people who've led them to this and say, yeah, pretty much they said we'd blame over Iraq, you lied to us. The alternative, which is just as likely I don't want to happen, is we will see some genuinely very right-wing politics then, because charlatans like Johnson go Farage. They're not going to stand up and hold up their hands and say, oh, okay, we did mislead you. Yeah, we ought to have said there's going to be a lot of pain in all of this. They will start to blame, they'll blame the EU, obviously, they're already blaming the EU for punishing us for leaving. I worry about EU citizens in Britain. I worry about ethnic minorities. You know, who are they going to turn on rather than turn on themselves? Who are they going to say is responsible for this if they are not responsible?
I mean, the way you allied Boris and Gove and Farage, I can't agree with. I mean, you know, the reason that Leave won the referendum was because they kicked Farage as far as they could from the centre stage.
Well, if you look at how they won, I mean, it's all rather historical now. They started off, I've actually dug out all the quotes from various people, I'm sure your listeners may have heard of like Dominic Cummings, as I say, never heard of. Said, we won't touch race, we won't touch immigration. And by the end, as Farage quite rightly said, they were running a UKIP campaign. It was all about 65 million Turks. Syrians are all about to come here.
And the 350 million a week.
So there's that point. But also, it's just the logic of the position. You know, the logic of the position they're in is driving them rightwards. The logic of the position is the liberal case for Brexit is, well, where is it? You know, where are all these Johnsons and Goves saying, well, obviously we want, a Norwegian deal so we can stay in the single market, have actually really quite a bit of control. The policy in Norway does not just affect the Brexit. They were all saying that at the beginning of the campaign, that's all gone. You know, to go back to Norman Cohn, if you don't stand up and smash these ideas on the head very early, they carry you along, and I think a lot of Conservatives are being carried along, most notably Theresa May, who, as I keep pointing out, did not vote for this.
But equally, May's passion has always been about controlling immigration. I mean, if you read her, that kind of the conference speech a couple of years ago, where it was just kind of compared to Genghis Khan in a dress by some people, you know, that's very clear that she really, really wants to do this. And, you know, in order to do that, you have to leave the single market because you can't have free movement. And
well, yeah, you say that. The immigration that most worries people, let's be frank about this, and the immigration that most worries people is immigrants coming from Pakistan who may be Islamic State. That's what worries people. Are people really that worried about French and Germans coming to Britain? And also, when she was Home Secretary, she didn't stop immigration from non-EU countries or cut it significantly. But again, going back to a point I made earlier, if Theresa May were to stand up and say, yeah, okay, I accept, I want really tough, big reductions in immigration, and I accept a large part of the country wants that as well, if you were then saying, but there will be a price to pay for this, it will hurt a lot of businesses, it will hurt agriculture, it will hurt the hospitality industry, it will hurt all kinds of small businesses and quite a few big businesses as well. But as long as but that's it, blood, sweat, toil and tears. If this is what we want, we have to pay the price. But again, she's not doing it. In her own way, she is, you know, she's just like Farage, she's not saying that to get what you want will involve sacrifices or trade-offs, to use her words. And I do keep saying, I think we're in a kind of phony war at the moment. I wonder what's going to happen when those sacrifices become evident. And as I say, it could turn around and be a liberal opportunity, or things could get an awful lot nastier.
So you use the word liberal quite a lot, and you sort of describe yourself as a liberal. I mean, what's your sort of version of liberalism?
Okay.
What would you like to see if you were in number 10?
If I was in number 10, as I should be.
Absolutely. Can I be culture secretary?
Yeah, of course you can.
Get to go to all the cricket matches.
Yeah, I think isn't there some opera as well?
Not so big on the opera, but I'll do the pop music.
I believe very strongly in human rights, and universal. Unlike the left, I don't believe that Muslim women have less rights than white women. I believe strongly in English liberties, including, you know, though it's often hard to defend freedom of the press. So, again, very strongly against Leveson and people like that. On economics, I'm probably more social democratic than liberal. I think there is a bit of a gap. I don't know if your foundation is filling this at all, but after the crash, there is less thoughtfulness from believers in neoliberalism or free market economics than I would expect. Not just about what went wrong in 2008, but about big, big questions now on why is it that average incomes are stagnating? Why is productivity stagnating? In other words, are the reforms sort of associated with Thatcher and Reagan, to generalise, massively, are they running out of steam? Are they failing to deliver now? And if so, why? And what can be done? There's kind of, perhaps Trump has killed it off, I don't know. There was kind of a last gasp free market conservatism, I thought, after the crash. And there wasn't enough people coming up with solutions or questioning why, again, another event no one expected had happened, and what can be done in the future. So I'm far more social democratic on economics.
Are there any people out there who you see as representing a decent enough fraction of those values?
Lots of people, yeah. This goes back to what we were saying earlier. It's very odd in Britain at the moment, with politics so polarised. There is a huge, millions upon millions of people who are essentially liberal, essentially centrist, who are just not represented in politics at the moment. If you were to take pretty much everyone from John Cruddas and Yvette Cooper from the left through to David Cameron, George Osborne, Nicky Morgan on the right, is excluded from mainstream, from leading positions in mainstream politics. It is a very strange position we're in, with this far left in control of the Labour Party, and it's rather cynical. I think he's very cynical. Politician Theresa May and a hard Brexit in control of the Tory party, and everything in between is somehow now impossible. But that in between is where millions upon millions of people stand.
So you don't buy the idea that May is actually what May is trying to do is to sort of sell globalisation to nationalists, if you like. She's trying to find a way to get the benefits without the costs. And you know, that she, I mean, a certain, well, certain, I mean, Philip Hammond, for example, his economics seem to be sort of fairly in the mould that you were talking about.
Well, I fully accept and I take your word that it may be what she's trying to do. I don't for the life of me see how she or Philip Hammond can achieve those objectives while going through Brexit. I just don't. It is, as people say, like fighting a war. It is the most difficult thing we've done since World War II. Again, just pointing out, that difficulty was never made clear to the electorate. And all these things of a new working class conservatism. Or do you remember there was Philip Hammond's meant to have ended austerity? Well, that's back. You know, it just won't be possible. There are huge opportunity costs to taking on something like Brexit, and forging a new type of conservatism is one of the things that's going to go into the dustbin of history, I think.
So, I mean, what do you do? I mean, what do you sort of see your own role as being? I mean, do you sort of wake up in the morning filled with rage or despair? Or?
I'm a journalist. I normally wake up thinking, oh my God, what am I going to write? And I've got a deadline in a few hours.
And what the hell was I drinking?
No, I've given up. You see,
I don't really see it as a job of journalists. I'm uncomfortable in being a spokesman. I mean, I really am highly suspicious of people like Owen Jones or Paul Mason or Boris Johnson or Michael Gove, who are on the one hand journalists, on the other politicians. And you think, well, who are they? What are they? Do they have? Do they feel any sense? Are they writing this because it's what they believe or what they found out, or are they saying that to get advantage within their own party? And it's never very clear to me who they are or what they are. They all seem rather slippery. I mean, I feel first of all, as a journalist, my first overwhelming duty is to my readers, just to try to be as honest with them as I can. And second, I don't think journalists on the whole make good joiners. We're not good committee men. You know, you should never ask us to organise anything or run a meeting or seek a consensus. So I don't see myself as a politician monkey. I don't think journalists are. They might be quite successful politicians, but I don't think they're very good journalists.
And you mentioned honesty there. I mean, one of the things which comes across, especially in your more recent writing, is your sort of your absolute contempt for people who don't tell the truth.
Yeah. Well, it's quite interesting now. We've now got a president of the United States who sort of lies all the time and quite deliberately, and calls truthful news fake news. And just to get back to what we were saying at the beginning, you know, yes, obviously, Amber Rudd, Theresa May are not like Trump. Obviously, I mean, I'm sure they would have voted for Hillary Clinton, but like this, if they were in the American election. But you can see them sniffing, all of them sniffing the wind like dogs, going, this works. He's got elected. He's doing quite well. And they are all now denouncing true news as fake news. And you can see everyone, all kinds of politicians are thinking, one, we can lie, and two, when people expose us, we can say they are the real liars. It's worked for Trump. You know, success in politics produces many imitators, and Trump is doing it, and as you quite rightly said, on the scoundrel left as much as the right.
And one final thing, which came up earlier, you said that no one really calls themselves socialists anymore, apart from obviously Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonnell.
Do they really call themselves socialists?
Yes, I mean McDonnell's written a. We believe in socialism with an iPad. Back in a few years ago, he wrote the Manifesto for 21st Century Socialism, which looked a lot like 20th Century Socialism.
Indeed. The point I was trying to make was this point I've been wrestling with for a long time is that when the Berlin Wall falls, when Cold War's over, history's over, all the rest of it, what happens to the left? Where does it go? And where it ends up in is a place essentially where any enemy of the West will do, however right wing. So to go back to what I was saying earlier, a 20th century socialist, at least a principled one, would look at Jeremy Corbyn and say, well, what the hell is all of this?
Attlee, for example.
Yeah, or people well to the left of Attlee. They would say, well, what do you mean? You're supporting people who think women should be veiled.
I mean, for me,
head to toe
for me, the Putin worship is the key thing, because Farage has exactly the same thing.
Yeah, or you're supporting Putin. I mean, it's understandable why Trump and Farage and Marine Le Pen would like Putin. You know, he's revived very cynically Russian Orthodoxy. He's a capitalist gangster. You know, he passes laws to legalise wife beating, and persecuting gays. You know, I mean, but what's Corbyn, what's the left going along with it all? And the essential point I make is the far left isn't really socialist anymore. It's just a vacuity. It's a reaction. It will go along with anything or anyone as long as they're anti-Western. It has no principled, thought-through programme of its own, which I think you can see with Corbyn McDonald. I mean, just because parties are unpopular doesn't mean they're a success. You know, the Labour Party in the 30s reduced to 55 seats, came back, and the ideas began then from the 1945 Labour government. The left under Thatcher in the 80s, well, you know, didn't get very far, but all kinds of things that were dismissed as loony leftism, political correctness at the time on gay rights, women's rights, anti-racism began there and became very widely accepted. You know, the Tories after 1997, not anyone took any notice of them. Banging on about Europe, as David Cameron said, but still, we're out of the EU now. I think when people look back at the rump of the Labour Party now, what good ideas are going to come out of there? There's nothing. There's just it's an attitude. It's not a programme. That's all they've got is just we won't stand for the national anthem. We'll make excuses for any enemy of Britain. There's no principle behind any of this. You know, that nothing represents the triumph of neoliberalism after 1989 as well as the banality of its enemies.
On that note, Nick Cohen, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Free Exchange from CapEx. I'm Robert Colville, CapEx's editor, and I hope I'll see you again next week. If you like this, please subscribe.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.